for the network's programs, and the Global Focus website is globalfocus.com for program guest information. Also, thanks to Joe Montaldo, UPRN network owner and ICAR International Director, for making these broadcasts possible. And in advance, great Memorial Day weekend to our listeners, and thanks to our past and present military servicemen and women for their excellent service to this country. Back to our featured guest, whose research and work I've so appreciated reviewing. Chet Dambek published his first op-ed piece with the Baltimore Evening Sun in the 1990s. Over the next 15 years, he worked as a reporter covering government, technology, and business for such publications as the Washington Business Journal, the Baltimore Daily Record, the Capital, and the E-Commerce Times. Chet, author of several books available and highly recommended at Amazon.com, is a reporter, editor, and copywriter who is interested in UFOs, conspiracy theories, and independent politics. Chet, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Great to be with you.
And Chet, I had the opportunity, thank you, of reading three of your latest works. These books are really excellent research reports. They provide new analysis data and information on the UFO and ET fields. They can be accessed at Amazon.com. I heartily recommend them. Now, Chet, I want to note here to our audience that clearly your purpose is to inform and educate the public. Your material is available at modest prices, and yet the information in these research books and papers, again, very timely and valuable.
Well, thank you. Basically, what I try to do is to approach the UFO subject in a rather sober way, like a news reporter. And I have noticed the reports that I write are not, they can be read in one sitting, but they cover some of the classic cases and some of the cases that are not that well known. And they're really based on documentation, whether it be, it's a combination of government documents, archived news articles from that are as old as 50 years old, and also eyewitness accounts from legitimate, what I call legitimate witnesses, which are willing to go on record. And in most cases, are sworn affidavits.
Yes, I noted that several of your sources were very highly credible individuals, and also I found it very ironic that so many of the article sources were from the Washington Post back in the 50s through 70s, and of course, big change there now, sea change, but those were excellent articles certainly back then. Now, I've got your three reports here. We can discuss them in any order. Just some really great cases and topics I'd like to discuss from them. The first report, Chet, I'd like to discuss a work entitled Proof of Extreme UFO Encounters Based on Physical Evidence and Eyewitnesses. And Chet, am I correct you place high value on eyewitness accounts, details, and reproductions of reported alien symbols, hieroglyphs, and insignia?
That's right, because if you really think about the UFO phenomena, I'm sure that there could be physical evidence, but most of it disappears or it never shows up. Yet we have a very small minority of UFO cases where individuals talk about symbols or hieroglyphs that they've seen and actually copied down. This is kind of interesting because some of those hieroglyphs have shown up in various cultures throughout the years, throughout the centuries, and what I did with this was go through only reports where the individuals that saw the UFO or had an encounter with a UFO actually were able to remember hieroglyphs or symbols and write them down, and we did a comparison of them. Interestingly enough, one of the most famous cases, or the most famous case, is a UFO crash in 1947, where one of the witnesses actually wrote down the hieroglyphs. I later compared these hieroglyphs with actual photographs of a neutron, and they're very similar. So we have hieroglyphs or symbols that basically are almost identical to that of subatomic particles. Now, you might say, well, what does that mean? It would seem to me that intelligent life would use some type of universal language, and the atom is, and the components of the atom is a symbol that would be known by any civilized or advanced civilization. So that's just, that gives you a little idea of where this particular report was going and what we try to do with it.
You know, I was floored by that example and other examples there that you reference in this report. Now, that first example, if I remember correctly, was your reference to the material shown to Colonel Jesse Marcel Jr. by his father, Major Jesse Marcel, the Roswell Army Airfield Intelligence Officer. And I'd like to quote here from Colonel Jesse Marcel Jr.'s website at www.marceljr.com. And again, the symbols that you've noted, I believe, also appear in part in the book by Jesse Marcel, The Roswell Legacy, The Untold Story of the First Military Officer at the 1947 Crash Site by Jesse Marcel Jr. and Linda Marcel, with foreword by Stanton T. Friedman. And I think that this is so cool. Now I'm quoting from Jesse Marcel's site just very quickly. On the way back, quote, on the way back to the airfield, Marcel stopped off at home at around 1 to 2 a.m. to show his wife and son the strange material he had found. Both his wife, Yoda, and son, Jesse Jr., examined the debris Jesse Sr. had brought home. Jesse Jr. remembers there were pink, purple, lavender symbols along the center sections of some of the small metallic I-beams in amongst the debris, end quote. And you know, Chet, what you just said here, I think it's so interesting. Your observation, Chet, you note the hieroglyphic or hieroglyph-like symbols copied by Jesse Marcel from memory have been found by quantum physics experts to bear an unusual resemblance to electron clouds. Wow.
Yeah, that's the one component that I was able to find that I don't think's been mentioned a whole lot. I don't remember reading it anywhere. So that as well as those same symbols have shown up in Apache medicine men's costumes or garb, where they dress up, which looks similar to an astronaut's uniform, and those same symbols, which they say the Apaches claimed came from the gods from the sky, were very similar to these symbols. So that's all circumstantial evidence, but at least we have something. We have something that we can compare with Marcel's symbols are very similar or almost identical to the neutron clouds, and the same symbols show up in the ancient Apache culture. So that by itself doesn't prove anything, but it is some circumstantial evidence which builds at least somewhat of a hypothesis that there is a connection between these, between the symbols and the UFO. So, and that's, if we stretch it to the point, it is some type of physical proof that these vehicles or whatever they are do exist. And if you look at UFO reports, very few of the reports actually will maybe about 1-2% talk about symbols.
No, and yet it's such a fascinating point. And, Chet, your research is so extensive. For example, you've noted symbols reported from unidentified craft across the world. You note an interesting symbol from Madrid, Spain, first reported in 1967, with a
right,
slightly different version in 1986 from a Madrid, Spain sighting. Also, now you've noted symbols on UFO sightings reported from Brazil, Belgium, and of the United States. Now, I thought, too, it was very interesting. You remarked that one series of symbols were reportedly seen in the United States on many UFOs from 1964, well, during 1964 and 1965. Also, the airship sightings of 1897 have been
right,
widely discussed. I had no idea that with these airship sightings of 1897, that certain symbol markings were seen on the craft. That's unusual.
Well, as you study this subject, you'll find, and again, my information is not firsthand. I've never seen a UFO. I've never had I've never seen an alien. I don't physically know that they exist. But if, by going into archives and researching the subject, you will find that there are sightings of UFOs, and they come in waves. In the turn of the century, there was such a wave, and people throughout the United States and the world saw airships. They call them airships. And the symbols that you're talking about are some of the, and they're very interesting symbols. They're very, 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 very beautiful, actually, some of them. And these are symbols that people at that time during these different waves, and then there was another, have copied down. Then in the 1948, there was another large wave of UFOs, and that extended all the way through the 1950s. So, I just picked this one aspect because if you really think about it, most aircrafts and our space vehicles, we put symbols on them, and it would stand to reason that so would another civilization that was sending UFOs or vehicles to another place. They'd want to say who they were or give some type of symbols. So when I came across the few cases, and I assembled them all together, that where eyewitnesses actually had symbols or reported symbols and copied them down, I tried to group them all together to look at that one aspect that I'm not sure too many people have looked at that aspect of UFOs. That is the symbols.
Absolutely. Pardon the interruption. You know, I think it's just a wonderful aspect of UFO information. And something else too, Chet, on Rendlesham, which has frequently been discussed, you make an interesting correlation there. You note that in those very interesting symbols that be engraved on the craft viewed by Sergeant James Peniston, former U.S. Air Force Staff Sergeant, 81st Security Police Squadron at Bentwaters Woodbridge Rendlesham Force events. What I think is fascinating is you mentioned, of course, not only the very intriguing nature of these symbols that seem to be engraved into the craft material. And here, let me see, as I remember it, the symbols seemed almost engraved or etched, as you note, on a smooth, opaque, black, glass-like surface. But what I think, too, is further interesting, Chet, is the fact that through your research, you have found that there are records from an account from 1800 Japan, where
That's right.
villagers viewed a strange craft which washed up on the shore. You noted the symbols, the woman who allegedly was on that craft, reportedly brought to the Japanese villagers, resembled those noted at the Rendlesham Forest UFO events. That's interesting.
Wait, yeah, in addition, the craft itself seemed to be similar to the Rendlesham's craft, and the woman was far than the type of female the natives had seen, and she was speaking a strange language. But you're right, the symbols of this craft, some of them are, or one or two of them are identical to the other one, which occurred in 1980. So I found that very interesting, and if you continue to compare some of the symbols of some ancient civilizations, they pop up there as well. I don't know if you've heard of the mythical continent of Mu, or the nation of Mu,
yes.
Which was some of the symbols that were found in that language. And I say it's mythical. Some people believe it was in fact a reality, but some of the symbols that are in that language are similar to these UFO symbols in the Japanese UFO. So we have these symbols showing up throughout our history on vehicles and in languages and lost civilizations. That's kind of to me that's very interesting.
You know, I think so as well. And again, your cases do run it from a modern history to historic, also ancient history, and also from that in the late 1800s. For some reason, I found this particular account very interesting as well. It was your report on an artifact perhaps a result of a UFO crash, found by a Dr. Sears, or Sayers, of Clayton, Georgia. Right. And it was reported in the July 23rd, 1887 edition of the Quincy Daily Whig newspaper. To me, it was very interesting. Allegedly, this artifact included a four-pointed star, an ancient bird reptilian figure, and smaller markings. To me, it's just another example of how widespread and yet unique so many of these artifacts can be.
Well, the bird, he said, resembled an extinct dinosaur. But the other thing he said was that the markings resembled on this blue ball, basically it was like a metallic ball. He was coming home from a patient's house, and he saw something bright and it crashed a few yards ahead of him, and he went and he dug up this metallic ball, and it had these markings on it. The other thing that was interesting about the four-pointed star and the bird of prey, which was on it, was there have been accounts that I've run across of abductions where one of the abductees spoke of the aliens wearing an insignia that was exactly described as having a bird of prey and a star on it. So I found that interesting as well. And that is an abduction that occurred in the 1970s, an alleged abduction that occurred in the 1970s. I may not be like some of your other guests, which may actually say they've seen aliens or they take them as a matter of fact. I still have to say alleged because I don't know for sure, but there's a lot of evidence pointing to the fact, in my opinion, that we have been visited by extraterrestrials or beings from somewhere other than planet Earth.
Well, thank you for being such an unbiased and dedicated researcher in the field. The research is appreciated, and you know, I'm thinking here about one of the shapes viewed by Sergeant Jim Peniston on the crash there during the Rendlesham events. One of the symbols included a triangle, and people in our network audience room, where we have many researchers and visitors and experts like yourself, could confirm to me as well that sometimes the triangle can represent an important shape with interaction with aliens. And also, you know, I know that there's, from your research, one receives the impression that there are definite commonalities among certain symbolic symbols, certain hieroglyphs. But there's such a diversity as well that might show that there is a spectrum of aliens or just diversity among perhaps beings in these craft visiting us.
Well, I mean, it could be, but my view from based on what I've looked at in documentation and so forth is I believe that the visitations are very, very rare, and they happen very rarely, and actual crashes or UFO crashes, maybe there have been 3 to 5 of them over the last 150 years. This is my take. And I don't think that the aliens or whatever they are, when I say I don't know exactly where they come from, because many scientists believe it's impossible to travel faster than the speed of light. They believe you can travel near the speed of light, which means that the closest possible alien universe, which may have life, would be maybe a 2 or 3 year trip. So I don't think it's an easy thing for them to come here, and I don't think that they have it's not like Men in Black, the movie, where there's thousands of them inhabiting our planet. And this is my view. But I believe there's a lot of evidence or circumstantial evidence that the government is aware of them and essentially pretty much tries to avoid answering questions and covers up as much of it as they can, and probably for national security reasons.
No thoughtful response. And you know, Chet, next we discuss special report entitled The Ancient Astronaut Papers, based on newly discovered FBI documents. That was a fascinating book or report. Chet, if I remember correctly, this report describes FBI interest in ufology with an intriguing example of such interest, their interest in a 1960 presentation at the Pipps Auditorium in City Park, Denver, by ufologists, an individual who at the time operated reportedly a Civil Aeronautics Authority airfield. So he was a person of some background there and, I guess, some presence. You note a summary memo and also, if I'm correct with that, also further handwritten memos. Very intriguing. Now, Chet, am I correct? The FBI even... The FBI report dated April 26, 1960, some of the materials redacted, briefly described background details on this ufologist giving that April 17, 1960 presentation in Colorado. Also, the audience's demographic details were noted, so there was some definite interest.
Yeah, well, I guess the point, I've gone through the archives of the FBI, some of them have recently been released.
Through FOIA, Freedom of Information Act.
They had to be NSA had to be sued and actually go to court to release some of the records, and they're so redacted that you can't get a whole lot out of them. But what you can get, you have to go through thousands of pages, but you will run across some interesting things. Now, you have to remember that the FBI and all these government agencies have said, since the beginning of UFOs, the flaps in the United States, that they don't exist, that they're not really interested in them, and it's just people's imaginations and seeing the planet Venus. Yet, they employ agents to covertly spy on these people that are talking about them. Now, that speaks volumes. You don't really have to say too much more. And this report was very detailed, and this agent was reporting this, and this was going to J. Edgar Hoover, and do you really think J. Edgar Hoover would be interested in something that was just a hoax or there was no validity or some concern for the security of the United States? I don't. So I think they wanted to know exactly what this individual knew and just how much information he was going to give and the nature of the information. And what I found interesting about this is that it happened in 1960, and this gentleman who gave this lecture was talking about things about warm-blooded dinosaurs and that the Earth's climate had been changed several times because of the Earth changing its axis. And that all sounds crazy until you read recent scientific reports where some scientists have come to believe, this was just maybe 6 months ago, that some of the dinosaurs were in fact warm-blooded. So this person that was giving this meeting was talking about things that scientifically had not even been established until recently, which I found that very interesting. But the other thing that he talked about was the reason why the government would not want this to happen, why contact with UFOs and their technology and aliens would be disastrous for the world and the world's economy. You recall that part of the report?
Yes, I did. That was fascinating. Not so much, if I remember correctly, the fear was not so much chaos, cultural chaos, but that the economy would definitely go through a chaotic period with, as you noted, alien advances that are almost permanent in nature. They don't have to be replaced.
Well, let's just, I've heard people talk about Tesla, who supposedly, the Tesla, the inventor, in the 19th century, early 20th century, was supposedly came up with free power, which could be generated wirelessly, and then suddenly, as the conspiracy theorists say, he basically died soon after, and his plans never got off the drawing board. Well, if you think about it, if you had aliens which could give us free energy, that would decimate the economy as we know it, because all the oil companies would no longer be needed. All those people that do those jobs wouldn't be needed. Everything would be totally changed within a twinkling of an eye. That's just one example. And some people might say, well, that would be a great thing, but you have to really think about how governments work. Governments work on a status quo or stability. Anytime you throw a wild card into the mix, you threaten the very existence of a government, of a country, of a world. At least that's what they would say. And I think that's a strong argument. And it was this individual's belief that that's why the government wasn't so much afraid of the aliens, but were afraid of the technology that they would bring forth, which would totally destroy the economy and their power as they know it.
Those are very powerful arguments, and it certainly presents them very well. Also, something else, Chet, that I found very intriguing in this discussion of the presentation of that ufologist from 1960 was the fact that he was discussing the concept of invisibility. Now, RD and invisibility is mentioned now in the field, but you note that this ufologist in that April 1960 presentation mentioned that extraterrestrials had informed him that they use invisibility to not make themselves known in the population. And you also reference that this technology reported by this ufologist was that the ETs could allegedly bend light and produce invisibility with the aid of a special magnetic field.
That was really fascinating, because that's exactly what some of the reports I've read, every once in a while they leak them out, that our own Defense Department's doing with light to create invisibility for military applications. So I guess the validity of this document was, one, the FBI was so interested in following these people around and writing every word they said, while at the same time they were saying that they didn't believe in UFOs and that they were just a hoax and people were just being hysterical. And two, here's a guy from the 1960s talking that's revealing some scientific knowledge that wasn't even known until recently. And three, he's talking about technology that just now our own military is trying to develop, using the same premises that he was talking about back in 1960. By the way, he redacted his name, so I don't know who he is.
Right, I noted that. And, you know, both the concepts he presented in that presentation per that FBI report and your summary are very, very intriguing. And, you know, another point as well, I think just referencing back to a portion of your title, mentioning that ancient astronaut, an ancient astronaut theory, it was well done. Here it is. Pardon me, the ancient astronaut papers. Of course, we have that very popular TV series on fame. But, Chet, you know that in this presentation in 1960 in Colorado, the ufologist mentioned the aspect of extraterrestrials seeding the Earth after a polar shift with the concept that male extraterrestrials may have had relations with intelligent female beings here. That's interesting. That really does presage that popular TV series now.
What? It did, and then in the second chapter I put in, what I did was, there's a book in the Bible, a controversial book in the Bible, the Book of Enoch, and he talks about the watchers, and essentially what Enoch, this prophet from the Old Testament, basically laid out the same things that this ufologist was talking about, but in biblical terms. And he talked about watchers coming down from the stars and how they started intermarrying or mating with the women of Earth, and how their offspring were giants, and how they were basically taking these people and their offspring, and they were able to conquer everyone else because they had technology, and they were teaching their women. At that time he was talking about astrology but they were giving them technology and teaching them mathematics and that type of thing and science. And by doing so, they put their group of people that they created into a whole new realm. But he also talks about, Enoch talks about that the people from the sky or the watchers, by doing so, had caused a real rift with their superiors, who were coming back to punish them for doing this, because by mating with the Earthlings, they essentially created a superior civilization, which would throw off the whole balance of Earth. I guess I hate to say this; it sounds corny, but it's like the Star Trek premise where Roddenberry said that advanced civilizations had the prime objective not to interfere with other civilizations that were in a progressive progressing themselves. So
those are strong points. And that Book of Enoch is noted as a very interesting extra-biblical book. And pardon the interruption. Go right ahead.
Say that again.
Go right ahead if I interrupted you there, Chet. Please pardon me. But I think your summary or your analysis on the work on the Book of Enoch, the references there to beings, superior beings, is really intriguing, and it does fall in with several researchers' concepts of slightly different take. But, for example, here it reminds me of Professor Mike Heiser's concept of a divine council with a group of very highly advanced beings, but with a first source or creator above and superior to them. And also, to me, it also recalls the work of L.A. Marzulli and Scotty Roberts. They both have different versions on these ancient beings who some believe interacted with the Earth population then. I like it. Your summary is very intriguing as well.
Well, absolutely, but you're absolutely right. And in this particular report, I do tie in, and again, this will be blasphemous to some people, and I don't mean to offend anyone, but ties in between Jesus Christ and ancient astronauts. And if you go through history, and I compiled some of them, there are many different cultures, actually 35 different beings that were supposed to be, their fathers were gods, so to speak. Like Jesus Christ was incarnate God, and so it is with about 25 other individuals that are found through different civilizations throughout history. Now, if you're a Christian, you may find that offensive, but I'm just laying out the facts as I come across them.
And that is your research. And, you know, Chet, also, a very important aspect on this article was your research through FOIA request, through FOIA, of the FBI documents you found. Now, there are two that were really key. First of all, you note a key handwritten memo by J. Edgar Hoover. And that prehistory, if I remember correctly, you note that on July 10th, 1947, a George F. Shulgin, Army Brigadier General, requested FBI assistance to find and question individuals who had witnessed flying discs. And though there are two responses that you actually also indicate, they follow that summary by the FBI that you followed his presentation in Colorado. On these two memos, the first, you note a July 15th memo by Hoover's friend Clyde Tolson, indicating that they should do this, in other words, help furnish that assistance to Army Brigadier General Shulgin as far as individuals who might have seen, witnessed flying discs. But also Hoover's reply was really intriguing. This is such excellent research on your part that he, Hoover, would agree to do this, but as noted in the handwriting, that he would, quote, insist upon full access to discs recovered, end quote. And that's just part of the quote. That's great research. I was really amazed.
Yeah, a lot of people, let me just touch on that a second. I put that in this particular report because I wanted to show people that J. Edgar Hoover had intense interest in the UFOs, and so did the United States government and the Army. And they had so many reports that this Brigadier General wanted the FBI to help them because they had to interview so many people and go through the cases. But J. Edgar Hoover was a little bit ticked off at at the Army, because when, in my opinion, he's referring to Roswell, when they captured the Roswell disk, they wouldn't let anybody look at it, including the FBI. And Hoover, from that point on, was very, very angry with them. So when they asked him for his help, his lifelong friend, Olson, said he thought it was a good idea. And as you pointed out, Hoover said, well, yeah, I might do it, but only if they agree to let us look at the disk, because last time they wouldn't let us look at it. And to me, that is just an amazing piece of evidence. Now, the detractors of that evidence will say he's talking about some small disks that were being that they had recovered, where people were doing hoaxes in California, and he was talking about that, the recovery of that type of disk. But it's hard for me to believe that the head of the FBI would care about seeing a hubcap that some kid threw out and made a hoax UFO report. I don't think he'd be interested in that. I think that J. Edgar Hoover would take the time to write a personal note in something that was very big. I'll also tell you this, that throughout the years, different senators and congressmen have tried without success, and the GAO. GAO also tried to get the release of the Roswell documents. And the bottom line is they were destroyed, according to the Army and the United States government. They were destroyed, and no one gave them the authorization to be destroyed. But the thing about it is, and I'm tying into Hoover and the disk, is I have another article from the Washington Post where Jack Anderson talked to some of his sources with the General Accounting Office, and they went down and did a report because a congressman from New Mexico, his name was Stephen Schiff, had them do it because he wanted to get to the bottom of the Roswell. And they told Anderson, his sources, he didn't name the source, but he said it was several of the investigators that he had a good rapport with, told him that they something really big happened there, and that they never saw the Army clamp up so tight, they couldn't have information at all. And they said they're not sure it was a UFO, but it had to be something so big that it's bigger than anything that that they'd ever come across, because all the doors were shut in their face. They couldn't get any information. So I'm saying that to point out that J. Edgar Hoover is not making personal notes about a hubcap or a hoax UFO. He wanted to see, I believe, the Roswell disk, and he wasn't allowed to see it. And those documents that I put in, those documents I put in the report, basically lay that out for the reader.
Yes, they do.
What I try to do when I run across something like this is I make it very brief and put it together so it just hits you like a punch in the face. And that's what it did to me. But the detractors will say, well, he was just talking about, hoaxes that they weren't letting him see. And you can detract anything. You can always give a counter explanation for any reasonable person. I think that would read those documents. You read them. Mm-hmm. It's hard to believe that he wasn't really interested in the real UFOs and not the hoaxes.
Yeah, that's a very strong argument. Very reasonable, very powerful. And again, that is one very memorable report. And I would highly recommend that everyone actually read all three of your reports. And that particular one being, well, I've got several here. Oh, let me see here. Where I just dropped it. The second report, the title is The Ancient Astronaut Papers, based on newly discovered FBI documents, that is available at Amazon.com. Well worth the read, and it's a very modest price. Chet wants to get this information out to the public so they'll be informed. The other two reports, and there are actually two or three other excellent works there as well, We Are Not Alone and They Are Not Our Friends, Hostile Aliens, Cases of Extreme extraterrestrial aggression. Excellent case accounts here. And the third, which is, the first, proof of extreme encounters based on physical evidence and eyewitnesses, which gives great summaries of different symbols and hieroglyphs that Chet has researched. And on that third report now, which I'm bringing up, we are not alone and they are not our friends, hostile aliens, cases of extreme extraterrestrial aggression. Before I get to some of the cases, I just want to mention again that great research you did, Chet, on that very popular Washington Post columnist. His articles also appeared in the Sunday editions of Parade on in different publications across the country, Jack Anderson. And boy, your information that you summarized there is very powerful.
So many people, and you got to remember, let me put it this way, the government's objective is to keep pretty much UFO community in disrepute. If they can label everybody that talks about UFOs as being kooks, they don't have to really deal with the problem or really worry about anybody being concerned about it. So I think that part of their strategy is just to let disinformation flow and even add to it. But in reality, they have, if you look at it, logically, you've had congressmen, senators, you've had affidavits from some of pilots, from airline pilots, from intelligence officers, people that have come out that have nothing to gain and everything to lose, talking about these incidents, and to just blow it off and say it's nothing but a bunch of bunk is a real mistake. And in this report about hostile aliens, I was shocked to find out some of the evidence, hard evidence or documentation, of actual harassment and physical harm that some of these so-called visitors had incurred on populations. In one case, a small island, many of the inhabitants, and in another case, a U.S. pilot, a National Guard pilot. So, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that's the gist of the thought that came from my mind.
No, very well said. You know, Chet, here I believe you're referencing, it's a very powerful segment there, on the fact that sometimes a negative result from interaction between these beings and humans does occur, including airplane crashes, such as that of, as the case you detail in full, that of Captain Thomas F. Mantell, a Kentucky Air National Guard pilot, killed in a crash while flying in the Fort Knox, Kentucky area. There are several reports that crash was caused by a UFO. And, several sources here. And also on that Brazilian case, apparently those events were investigated by Brazilian military and intelligence. There's been quite a bit of evidence that has been obtained about some of the injuries that were incurred. And also, I'm trying to find my note here. There was also a case back in the prior century. I believe it was in Maracaibo. Would that be near Venezuela, where a family was harassed?
And the thing about that, Teresa, is that those two harassments by UFOs occurred almost 100 years apart. Yet they were very similar. The injuries were the same, and so were the eyewitness accounts. So then again, as a reporter, I say, well, wait a minute, maybe there's such a strong parallel between what occurred in Brazil and this other event 100 years prior to that. So that makes a stronger case for me to believe that something, in fact, has been happening. There are periods where there are UFO flaps, and there are cases where people are injured or burned in this case.
And you also note, and pardon my interruption there, that you note that documents were released by the Brazilian Air Force regarding some of the effects, some of the harassment incurred by local residents of an island with many of its residents, fishermen. And, you know, Chet, here I'd like to note that ufologist Gerald Sims, in an interview with me, and I believe also in at least one of his books there on implants, notes some of the UFO-related events that have occurred in South America. And I have a feeling that sometimes the events there can be even a bit more violent or a bit more aggressive.
Well, I think they pick areas where they're not going to where it's very secluded and the people are basically cut off from the rest of civilization. And a lot of these eyewitness accounts, one of them was from a doctor who actually treated some of these people, and it's really tough to dispute the same reports that you're getting, similar reports over and over again from people that really have no reason to lie or in fact most of them are scared to death because they feel like they're being harassed by some type of supernatural creatures because they didn't know what to think. But yeah, it's amazing that something like this, and this is something that went on for several months. It's amazing that we didn't hear much about it at all. In fact, I never heard anything about it until I went through these documentations. I don't think the public at large even knows that these things occurred.
And, you know, that's another reason why I think it's so informative. Much of the information, or there is a great deal of information in those reports that I hadn't heard of, and I found it quite surprising and thought-provoking. It's really excellent research. And on Thomas Mantell, Captain Thomas Mantell, you know, quite a lengthy segment there. For example, you give the statements by different investigators to the crash of his F-51 Mustang. You note that a former U.S. Army Air Corps commander, James F. Dussler, told UFO investigators Annie McPhee and Jerry Washington that, and as your article cites here, per those investigators' records, quote, the damage pattern was not consistent with an aircraft of this type crashing into the ground, end quote. And you also give a host of other reasons where to try to dispute the idea of a UFO crash, other theories were presented, but some of them were just really not very credible, such as the planet Venus. Certainly a pilot of that achievement would know that that was not the planet Venus. And
also, this was daytime. And this was daytime, and it was a cloudy day, so I doubt if he would have been chasing in broad daylight. I don't even think he could see it. But that's what made... Well, Thomas Mantell was a glider pilot in World War II. He was a decorated warrior. He was out on an exercise with two other National Guard pilots, and at that time it was the Army National Guard. It was a few months before the Air Force was created, and he essentially they were called because some of the an airport had saw a metallic object, and they wanted to know if there was any pilots in the area that could investigate and see what it was. And of course, so Mantell agreed to do it, and there was three of them. They went, and Mantell saw it. He got the closest to it. He said it was a huge metallic object, and he asked permission to basically pursue it. And he did, to the point where he went above. According to the Army, he didn't have an oxygen mask. But there's conflicting reports where a couple of his buddies said he was the only one with an oxygen mask, and that's why he was given the okay to go after it. But the story changed. To make a long story short, well, it was actually a short period of time. The closer he got to it, it kept on moving, and he tried to get as close as he could. And the next thing that happened was he was gone. They found his body, supposedly, in his aircraft. Well, I say supposedly is because when the inspectors got to the area where the crash had occurred, the body was gone. They'd whisked it away. That's bad. That's a bad thing. That makes people wonder. Secondly, his last words, according to two different eyewitnesses who were in the radio room, Mandel said, "Oh my God, there's people in this thing," and that was his last words. So, those that believe that Mantell saw too much and was destroyed by an alien craft believe that, in fact, this was covered up by the government for the obvious reasons. Can you imagine if the United States government admitted to the people in 1948 that one of their air pilots had been shot down by a unidentified flying objects and they could not catch it and they could not keep it on radar? I think it would cause a real problem. So it seemed to me, based on the evidence that I read, that they went through an elaborate scheme to cover up what really happened. That's my take.
You provide excellent details on it, and Chet, you really indicate the immediacy of the request by Godman Flight Tower to Captain Mantell, the flight leader there, of the four F-51s, to take a look at the object and try to identify it, end quote. And you also note, among all the details, there are several, and they're very interesting, was the fact that there were telephone calls to the Godman Air Force Base outside Louisville from the Kentucky State Highway Patrol as to several individuals from Maysville, Kentucky, viewing strange aircraft. Also, individuals from Irvington and Owensboro reported viewing an unusual craft. So, to me, it seemed like definitely an event of great immediacy and concern.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because, yes, there was a lot of corroborating witnesses throughout the whole event. And it just seemed like, again, the same pattern came in that you saw in Roswell. The Army just clamped down on it. And it was gone. It disappeared. I mean, when one cover story didn't work, they came up with a second. When that didn't work, they came up with a third. Finally, they had to admit there was something in the air. So they said, "Well, it was a top secret skyhook balloon. We couldn't tell you." He didn't know what it was, and that's what he was chasing. So that sounds like a feasible story. But the problem I have as a reporter, I've seen this pattern in politics. People cover things up. They come up with cover stories. You see it over and over. You saw it in Watergate. You saw it with Bill Clinton. You see it throughout our government. And even when UFOs aren't involved, where people try to come up with different stories to hide the truth. And essentially, I just, the official account of this event smelled fishy. That's any way I could say it. And the more they lied, the more it became evident that they were covering something up. And based on the witnesses that did come forward, it's reasonable to believe that this pilot was basically destroyed by some sort of alien craft. That's my conclusion anyway.
Right, and he lost his life as a hero. Trying to find out, to identify, and investigate the unknown, an unknown craft. Those are really excellent details in that segment. Of course, throughout that report there, it's jam-packed with very intriguing information. We've come up now to the top of the hour, Chet. Now, would it be convenient for us to end it now? Should we instead continue it for another 15 to half an hour? What would be your preference? I'll tell you, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your being here tonight. It's the beginning of a long holiday weekend, and I know I'm really appreciating the discussion, and others are in the room very much.
Well, no problem. Why don't we go for another 15 minutes after your break? How's that? Will that work for you?
That sounds just great. Thank you so much. And okay, then I'll just announce now to our room and also to our network and FM station. We'll be back in about 10 minutes' time. And thanks so much for joining us this evening, and thank you, Chet. So we'll be right back in 10. Thank you.
provocative and informative guests to hit the airwaves.
That's right, you do. And it all happens right here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network every Monday night at 11 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook, as well as mindcemetery.com.
Hi everyone, I'm Stephanie Benetti.
And I'm psychic medium Christopher George.
Together with Second Sight NYC Radio Show.
We are happy to announce that we are airing the second annual New York City Paranormal Expo Face at Moravia, New York, Saturday, June 16th.
And we'll be covering this event live on Saturday from 1 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on UFO Paranormal Radio. This is stacking up to be a can't-miss event with great guests from all over the country.
There will be psychics giving readings,
guest speakers, vendors, entertainment.
Of course, there will also be three paranormal investigations with some of the most prominent names in the paranormal community.
We will be interviewing all the guests and getting the first-hand accounts of the expo.
Second Sight NYC Radio Show is known as the show that even the spirits listen to.
We're the first and last stop for Paranormal Talk Radio.
Join us, everyone, June 16th on UFO Paranormal Radio.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Light up your night with The Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Hi, I'm psychic medium Chris George.
And I'm Stephanie Minetti. Psychic medium, are you sure about that, Chris? It's more like psychic extra large.
Yeah, real funny, Minetti. Defending him being my girlfriend, you would know. Together, we have Second Sight NYC, a parapsychic radio show based out of New York City.
Join us each week as we journey into the unknown. Let's cross the threshold of reality together.
We take a fun and no-nonsense approach to our show, and we love to interact with our audience. Each week, you can expect a great guest, interesting topics, and strong opinions by myself and Stephanie.
As well as rapid readings, psychic dream interpretations, and the gemstone of the week. And don't ask us a question that you don't want an answer to.
Give us 2 hours of your time to inform, enlighten, and entertain you. Let the journey begin.
Join us.
Hello, everyone. Trece Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Focus's new time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Come join the discussion.
Welcome back, everyone. I think I am live now. I'll put the network room on mute, and I just wanted to again notify our listeners that this is the second segment of our interview with Chet, with guest Chet Dembek. For 15 years, Chet Dembek has served as a reporter covering government, technology, and business for major publications. Chet authored several books, is a reporter, editor, and copywriter, who also is interested in UFOs, conspiracy theories, and independent politics. And also, just if I could take a moment to, oh, thank you, Raven. I just wanted to quickly note to our audience as well not to miss the other programs on the network, including UFO Undercover with Joe Montaldo as host, Wednesday evenings at 8 p.m. Eastern, and also Thursday evenings, Second Sight NYC.
Congratulations, you won.
Psychic medium Chris George and Stephanie Benetti. That's Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, Fridays before this program, 7 to 9, Through the Keyhole with field researcher Kayla Dolan, again, Through the Keyhole, and a Saturday, we have a program. It's lots of fun. Church of Neighbors with Jeffrey Pritchett as co-host. That's 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern. And lastly, Monday's a new program for us. It's with the husband and wife team, Chip and Nicole, and the name of that is Mind Cemetery. You know, great programs on the network. Don't miss them. Now, Chet, back to your great reports. And, you know, I noticed reading that I think both you and I, Chet, attended the same press conference in November 2007 in Washington, D.C. It was at the National Press Club at a press conference event sponsored by James Fox, documentary filmmaker, and Leslie Kane, investigative journalist and representative of the Coalition for Freedom of Information. And you know, Chet, your report notes two excellent cases that I believe were discussed in part or at least referenced at that November 12, 2007 press club, the first being one from Tehran in 1976. Now retired Air Force General Parviz Jafari was at that attended National Press Club event. Very interesting case there on his Phantom F-4 jet, and just quoting, he was a major and squadron commander at the time, was ordered by the Air Force Command to approach in his Phantom F-4 jet a large UFO observed over Tehran, end quote, and that was just from some of the proceedings there at the National Press Club. Well, that was really an unusual case.
Yeah, well, actually it was unusual, but it was common. What I mean by common, you're right, it is unusual and they're very infrequent, but what he experienced is very similar to what a lot of these cases the pilots experience. The object seems to be coming straight forward, like it's going to collide with them, then suddenly makes a maneuver that's impossible for an aircraft to make, and it doesn't collide. And the other thing that happened to him and has happened to other pilots of airliners and military aircraft is that he lost some power. He lost his power temporarily. If you recall that incident. And he had tried to basically put his target his missiles on the UFO, and suddenly the system just failed. And that's the same thing that has occurred at the Minuteman silo bases when UFOs buzzed them and suddenly they would no longer operate. You recall those incidents?
Yes,
over a period, yeah, I'm sure you have. So you're right. It is an unusual, it's a rare experience, but a lot of those components or those same things happened, a loss of power, being essentially played with by the UFO or challenged to the point where the pilot believes that his life is in danger. And then, and they all report that these alien UFOs make maneuvers that are impossible to make with any aircraft known to them. And the final analysis is, in his case, he went, That's when Iran was still run by the Shah, and he went to a U.S. intelligence officer, and he basically knew that it was a UFO, but then afterwards, that was it. No one would talk about it anymore. And that also occurs. Everyone denies that it was anything of significance.
But yes, you presented a very powerful report there on that particular event there in 1976 over Tehran. Also, Chet, your research details the 1987 JAL, Japanese Airline Flight 1628 event, where a veteran pilot, pardon the pronunciation, Captain Kenju Terauki, or Terauki, and co-pilot viewed a UFO trailing their craft. That craft was reported as being an enormous size, reportedly larger than two aircraft carriers.
Right, and that is a common occurrence as well. I've got these reports essentially from the New York Times, the Washington Post archives. So these are not reports that I'm pulling out of a UFO book. These are actual news accounts. And why I like news accounts? If you recall the Kennedy assassination, right after the Kennedy assassination, I was basically very fine, but I recall that some of the newspapers immediately came out that Cuba was involved. Then suddenly that disappeared. If you look at and in Roswell, the first news accounts talked about that the Army had captured a flying disc. Then that story changed immediately within hours. So I like these initial reports because they usually are unfiltered. No one has got to them yet to spin the story or change it. And so it was with this particular story that you just said, the Japanese airliner. They experienced something that was highly unusual, and they, the pilots talked about a huge UFO. Not something that's just, a regular aircraft, but something that's probably the size of a football field. And this is a consistent theme on some of these airline pilots and military pilots. If you remember, Mantell talked about a huge disc. These aren't small craft. So, you're right, and I didn't mean to interrupt you on that, but that's exactly true. Your airline was buzzed by this huge UFO, and when it went, again, they felt that their lives were in danger, and that's why I point out in this report that UFOs don't, these alien aircraft, or whatever they are, interdimensional, if there is such a thing as other dimensions. Some scientists say that that's not true either. But whatever these vehicles are, whoever's piloting them, they're certainly not friendly to the extent where they're trying to calm our nerves and tell us who they are. If anything, they're very evasive, and they invade our airspace, and they come and go as they please. And they scare the hell out of people, especially pilots.
Those are very strong points there. And you know, Chet, as well, at that November 2007 press conference, John Callahan, a retired FAA official, was describing an event with regard to Alaska. I'm not sure it's the same one that's referenced in your work. This one involved a Japanese airline 747, and this is interesting. I'm just quoting here from the November 2007 event. Data includes visual confirmation, air-based and ground-based, radar confirmation, videotape radar evidence, air traffic voice communications, and official reports, end quote. So some of this information really gives one pause. And you know, you've got another great case, several actually, in this report. And this one is it's an account of a Captain Matthew A. Van Winkle and a UFO's right. near collision with a Pan Am airliner. And this event was noted in the Washington Post in an article published on March 12, 1957. The pilot successfully took evasive action. But you know what's really, I thought was really intriguing? The 1957 Washington Post article noted that the Strategic Air Command ordered the scrambling of jet fighters for investigation and pursuit of the UFO.
Right.
Wow.
And, and the amazing thing is that, I think I pointed out in the report, you have to really think about it. These pilots, they jeopardize their career. In fact, they probably destroy their career when they come out and they tell the story. Prudent thing to do would be to keep their mouth shut and forget about it. Because, essentially, they're marked for life once they open their mouths. Mm-hmm. So that's why, to me, as a reporter, someone has a lot to lose and yet insists on a story that people will ridicule them for. That's a strong witness, in my opinion. It gives credence to their story.
It
because
certainly does.
Why,
mm-hmm.
You know, and again, the officials, and I've been at press conferences where the reporters just laugh at these type of things. It becomes a big joke. But if you look at it objectively, these people who had everything to lose and absolutely nothing to gain came out and staked their reputation, probably destroyed their careers because something had occurred that was extraordinary and they felt obligated to tell people about it. So, and again, if you really look at that objectively, it certainly wasn't a friendly thank you handshake. The way it was coming at him like he had to take evasive action. He thought he was going to be destroyed and his crew. And you have to ask yourself this question. This is how many airliners have disappeared or been destroyed and we don't know the reason why? It could be that they did have an encounter that the UFO didn't blink its eye and get out of the way. Who knows? Of course, I can't prove that, but I mean, I'm just wondering.
No, but those are very thought.
To occur.
Yes, those are very thought-provoking arguments. Again, pardon my interruption. You know, Chet, your great discussion there on UFOs and the importance of their flying in our airspace also is reflected by the concern of such organizations as NARCAP, or the National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena, with their website at, Anomalous Phenomena, at their website at www.narcap.org, again, National Aviation Reporting Center on Anomalous Phenomena. Because, you know, NARCAP, and I'm quoting here from their webpage, quote, NARCAP is interested in both current and historical UAP incidents and observations. We are specifically interested in those cases involving concerns for aviation safety, end quote. So that argument is right on point. Now, we've got, let's see, it's 8:25. I've got about four other cases I'd like to discuss, but I don't want to, I'll be quick because you've already been very generous here in extending the interview. One paper, too, that I also love is the Christian Science Monitor. And, boy, Chet, you detail it's a fascinating account of a UFO sighting by an Apollo flight engineer, Julian Sandoval, on July 11th. Well, the article was published in the Christian Science Monitor on July 11th, 1966. The sighting was about 18 miles to the north of Albuquerque. The sighting was of a 1 to 1.5 hour duration. You know, to me, that's a very strong witness, an Apollo flight engineer.
Exactly. In fact, when I put this report together, I did my best to find out, to really, really go through the different archives and find only what I considered very reputable people. And you can't get much more reputable than he is. I mean, here's somebody that worked on the Apollo spacecraft, which is the nexus of what we've, as a country, have, well, what the world has really achieved in space exploration. It hasn't been surpassed yet. And somebody's just going to look at something in the sky and say, hey, that's a UFO. Here's a scientist, an engineer, who's going to look at this and say, my God, what is this? And that's what he did. He saw something that he believed was not of this world. He and other people that we've quoted in this particular report.
And he would know the current standard of avionics aviation. So that too, that segment is very interesting as well. Now, Chet, here, as we sort of come up, I've got two more, actually about three or four. First of all, if I could just note the importance of this expert here. You note an article appearing in the Washington Post on February 23rd, 1950, which includes a quote or citation from a commander, Robert D. McLaughlin, a graduate of the U.S. Naval Academy and also an expert on guided missiles. And the interesting quote, the substance of that information is that Commander McLaughlin is noting that these flying saucers were spaceships and the pilots were from other planets. So I'm paraphrasing here, but that's quite a concept.
Well, and it's a concept that a lot of military men in high places, all the way up to the highest ranks of the Pentagon, believed at that point in time, and continued to believe, but they weren't allowed to talk about it. These people were very practical. Most of them served in World War II. They saw combat. They knew. They analyzed things very quickly. They didn't sit there they saw that these vehicles were hostile. They saw that they were maneuvering based on intelligent guidance, and they knew that they weren't from here because the technology was far too advanced than anything that we ever had. They knew this. That had been proven to them by engineers and their scientists. So they came to the conclusion, well, they must be from another world. That's a pretty obvious conclusion. It just seems that whoever the powers be are, who really run things, have done very well in getting the average American and person of the world to look at UFOs as being some type of joke. But if you really look at it logically, what else could it be? Some type of craft that's being operated by an intelligent being. And that's what he thought, and many of his peers in the Pentagon. And they probably still do. I'm sure they know a lot more about it now than they did then. But then again, I don't think they know a whole lot about it. That's another thing I've come to believe, that that is the government, knows very little about what these aliens are up to. I don't believe that they're working with them. I don't believe that, at least I haven't seen the evidence. I think that the aliens basically have their own agenda, and they're not sharing it with us.
Those are very thought-provoking arguments. And Chet, in my last reference here to this, we're coming up to the half hour. You know, Chet, that argument of yours, your last argument too, seems very strongly reflected in a very intriguing account that you note in your report by Michael Chinigo. I don't correctly pronounce his name. Michael Chinigo, an INS, probably International News Service reporter. His report was detailed in an article, you note, appearing in the Washington Post on September 19th, 1954. Now, the really, to me, what I find fascinating about this is, yes, Michael Chinigo, an American journalist, did see on September 18th, he reports seeing a craft over Rome, cigar-shaped, confirmed by radar for a period of about 39 minutes, as you note. But what I find, too, really intriguing is that the United States Defense Department also is describing the article as noting the description of the craft as a, quote, clipped cone, end quote, including the description, the term two semi, or the description two semicircular discs. And also, the DOD report then suggests, or the DOD summary then suggests, that the UFO could be a type of, as you note, quote, Allied experimental machine, or perhaps a British craft, end quote. That sounds as though they're trying to really firmly identify this craft for themselves.
Right. I think that... Well, that particular response could say, well, that makes people as much, well, it's just an experimental craft, or it's one of our allies. Mm-hmm. But in reality, I don't think they knew what it was. And, they're never going to say that, of course, because to admit that they don't know what it is would be to admit that they're not all powerful. And I don't blame them. I wouldn't admit it either if I was in their shoes. But, yeah, I guess what's so strong about my approach is very simple. I am not a ufologist, but I'm interested in the subject, so I try to go to the horse's mouth. And really, any researcher, and anybody can research, all you have to do is go to the library or go to different places and look up the archives, and you will find some, when you start to string all these articles together, you'll see a common theme, and you'll see many of the same type of behavior and outcomes. And one constant is that in the initial reports, you get the clearest picture of what really happened, and thereafter, you get a lot of cover stories and Who Struck John and Planet Venus and, you know, weather balloons and, experimental craft. And I'm not saying that there aren't some experimental craft that have been mystery for UFOs, but what I'm saying is there are some true UFOs that are unexplainable.
And, you know, great points. Chet, my final case, and I'm adding it here because I am a member of ICAR, and we have excellent experience or reports, and there were some correlations here, at least in one aspect, and that is an account you note. It was described in an Associated Press article of May 23rd, 1977. It was an apparent abduction event, and ICAR specializes in abductions and helping the community. We also have a number of great ufologists on board as well in the organization, and other scientific and other experts. Now, in this article, May 23rd, 1977, AP article, reportedly a Chilean corporal named Armando Valdez, serving as a patrol leader of a Chilean soldiers unit, at the time of this apparent abduction incident, and I'm quoting here from your article, quote, ordered to take up their arms as he went to investigate one of two bright objects that landed only 500 yards away from where he and his men had set up camp for the night in Chile's north desert country, end quote. Now, the soldiers assert that Corporal Valdez, as you note, disappeared from their sight, but 15 minutes afterward was found by his soldiers. Initially, he was in an unconscious state. And this is the next point that really floored me. He was bearing approximately 1 week growth of beard. And that would, to me, suggest a lapse of time. That type of anomaly has occurred in experience accounts to ICAR.
It happens a lot. Almost of the true abduction accounts, it happens. A time loss, a time distortion, which is very common. When the first Air Force guards came in Rendlesham, when they approached the craft, there have been reports that I've read that essentially their shadows were out of sync with their movements. They would move their hand, and the hand wouldn't move as their hand did for a few seconds afterwards, like a delay. And I mean, I could go on and on. There's been abduction cases where the people in the same night, two different groups of people, talked about their voices going into slow motion, and they started going into slow motion. So some scientists believe that has something to do with approaching the speed of light, or slowing down from the speed of light, or near the speed of light, and creates a time distortion. In the case of the corporal, it could be that he was taken away for a while, but he was at such a high speed that for him, as Einstein said, if you're traveling in a spacecraft, this gets far out there, but if you're traveling in a spacecraft that's approaching the speed of light, everything on the craft is much slower than what's going on the outside. So what you may have spent a week in the spacecraft, but only a couple minutes have passed on the outside. There's a distortion in time. So that's the way some people explain it. But in his case, he did. He came back with a semi beard, and his watch also indicated that he'd been gone for a while.
Those are very intriguing points. And, you know, I haven't been able to, during this interview, I've not been able to cover even the largest portion or segment of the cases and accounts you've researched. The cases, some of them are very new, or if they're ones, and those that aren't new, you have interesting new details on them, such as those shadow anomalies with the Rendlesham events. And I just have to commend you. Thank you, Chet, for a very dedicated researcher, very unbiased. You aren't an experiencer, yet you show an interest in this field, which knows a great deal of courage and very professional dedicated detail as a researcher and also author. I highly commend your reports. Please be a return guest. Anything else that you'd like to say? And again, thanks so much for being a wonderful guest.
Well, no, it's been my pleasure, and I would just say this. Keep on searching. You'll find the answer.
Thanks again. Well said. And good night, everyone. Have a great Memorial Day weekend. Thanks again, Chet. It was a pleasure. Thank you, sir. A great weekend, all. Keep safe this Memorial Day weekend. And thanks to our military servicemen and women who helped make it possible for us to have such a holiday. Have a great day there, guys. Bye-bye.